Yeah,
Okay.
fire it up.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to a special edition of the LFC Red Poets podcast. I'm your host, Les Lawson, and tonight I'm joined as usual by Tom Keegan and Pete Warburton. We have a very special guest tonight as we approach the 35th anniversary of the Hillsborough disaster, and I'm delighted to be joined by one of the nicest ladies I've ever had the privilege to meet, Jenny Hicks. So, welcome, Jenny. As I say, I hope you enjoy as best you can this podcast, and thank you very much for coming on. So,
Oh, you're welcome.
we'll start, Jenny, and take you back to, to that day 35 years ago when you lived in Middlesex, and you left your home with Trevor and your two daughters, and your lives were never the same again after. And while you're talking about that, could you just tell us a little bit about, Sarah and Vicky, and what they're like? Because to a lot of people, they're referred to as the 97, but they were all individual. They had all their individual likes and ambitions. And I know both of them were big fans of Steve McMahon. So tell us a little bit more, if you don't mind, Jenny.
Well, yeah, it was. They both did like Steve McMahon. Vicky, in particular, she used to write match reports. Vicky was my youngest daughter. She was 15 at the time of Hillsborough, and she fancied herself as a sports journalist. So I had this old typewriter, as they were then. For anybody listening, we used to have things called typewriters. For anybody who remembers them. And so every Sunday morning, we'd be up at a, we used to really, the matches then were Wednesdays and Saturdays back in the 80s, weren't they? Wednesday nights and Saturdays. So on a Sunday morning, there she'd be type, type, typing away. And I never got to read these match reports till sadly after she died and after she was killed at Hillsborough. And they were so biased, they were funny. And that's no, they were. Liverpool couldn't put a foot wrong, especially Steve McMahon. Everything that Steve McMahon did was right. But Sarah was also, my eldest daughter Sarah, who was 19 at the time of the disaster, she loved Kenny. Absolutely huge Kenny Dalglish fan. And yeah, so, but these match reports, Steve McMahon, Trevor, my ex-husband, took them to Steve McMahon when his book was being published. Well, sort of when he knew, we found out he was writing a book, and he thought the match reports were so funny, particularly the bits about him winning every game. So he published them in his book. I don't know whether you've read McMahon's book, Macca Can.
No, I haven't.
And
I have loads of autobiographies and I always buy them when they come out, but I never ever read them.
well, you should try it. It'd probably go in really cheap now because it was years ago. So you should try and get hold of Steve McMahon's, because some of Vicky's match reports are in there, and they are hilarious, honestly. As I say, talk about bias, but there you go.
Yeah. So that day, I mean, when I remember watching the documentary that was produced by Jimmy McGovern, I think it was,
Yeah.
and it tells yours and Trevor's story that day. Every time I think about that and watch that program, it breaks me heart because, you all went as a family, as we all, we me, Tom and Pete all were at Hillsborough that particular day. We all made our separate ways there, hoping to see Liverpool, get to another Wembley Cup final. We all went with the same hope and ambition. And yeah, 97 never went to another match. There was countless of others injured and traumatized and are still traumatized today. And yet, you go with a car of four and end up driving home in the early hours of the Sunday morning, minus two people, and your lives would never be the same again. And then, as the days afterwards approach, you're getting your house surrounded by journalists. How did you even cope with that, Jenny? It just sort of breaks my heart just thinking about it.
I wish I had a simple answer to how you cope with that. I don't have one. I really don't know how we coped, particularly, in the beginning. I mean, we drove to that football match, as you rightly said, as a family. Trevor and I and our two girls, and with the hopes we were going to beat Forest that day and go to the, to the cup final. And then after identifying our daughters on that dirty gymnasium floor in body bags, we were questioned by police as if we were criminals, asked how much we'd had to drink, how much the girls had had to drink. And then after midnight, we got in our car and had to drive back home to London and to North London. And so when I went to that match that morning, I went as a family of four. Trevor and I drove back that night as a couple. That couple, 2 years later, that couple split up. Trevor and I split up. So the family that went to that football match no longer exists, Les. There's no, that family who went didn't exist. After 2 years, that family just didn't exist anymore. So how do you deal with that? I wish I had some kind of thing that would help others that find themselves in horrendous situations like that. But I just don't know. As I say, when I think about it now, it's overwhelming. It really is overwhelming. I think you just keep waking up every morning, you keep breathing in and out, and you just move forward. One of the things that certainly helped was the Hillsborough Family Support Group being set up in the July afterwards. So within 3 months, I was mixing with other families who'd lost their loved ones in the disaster. And I could see the pain and the suffering that they were going through. And it sounds an awful thing to say, but being amongst people who were suffering the same as I was, I realised I wasn't the only one. And we shared, it was a shared pain and suffering. Without that, I don't quite know how I would have moved forward. So it was certainly the fact that there was a group, I was mixing with others in exactly the same situation and who were suffering the same pain as I was.
Yeah, I mean, when again coming back to the Hillsborough documentary, a minute, there's a part in that which I find, well, there's a lot of it that I find difficult to watch, but one of the worst parts of it is when the one ambulance comes onto the field, and one of your daughters gets put into it, and Trevor has to make a decision whether to stay or go.
Oh
How
God, yeah.
anybody could make that decision when you don't know how your other daughter is, but one of them's going to hospital. You couldn't make the right decision, could you? Whichever way
No.
you felt, you'd
No.
have felt you were doing the wrong one. I mean, we've all, I've only got one son. Tommy's got four. Pete's got a son and a daughter, and I don't know how in that situation anybody would have been able to make a decision. And I've got so much admiration for Trevor for what he did, because it's like he just couldn't win whichever one he did. If he'd have stayed at the ground, he'd have felt guilty about not going in the hospital, in the ambulance. So how poor Trevor got over that as well, and he had to explain that to you, and then you were left sort of standing, wait at your designated meeting point, after the people have been let out the ground. And the other thing to make people aware of as well is, back in the day, there was no mobile phone. So, if you're in a different part of the ground, because you were in the seating area, if I remember rightly, that you're just stood there wondering where everybody is, and the longer you're waiting, obviously, the more you must be tearing up inside as well, thinking about what you think might have happened.
Yeah, and I was taken to the Hamerton Road police station, and I had to give descriptions of all three, of Trevor, of Sarah and Vicky, down to whether they had moles or warts or whatever. And then taken to the boys' club, where I was just, it was horrendous, actually, because I didn't know. In fact, I was the first one at Hamerton Road Police Station. And it was, I didn't have any money. I didn't have any car keys. They were all, obviously, my bag was locked in the car. So I was in this strange city that I didn't know. Well, I was totally dependent on what the police were telling us or not telling us, because basically they didn't tell me anything. And in the end, it was a social worker at Hamerton Road Police Station about 7:30 in the evening that suggested he take me to the Northern General Hospital to see if any of my family were there. And that was the most sensible suggestion that I'd heard from leaving that football match at 4 o'clock, when we were finally allowed to leave the ground. And that's when I found out, I was told by a doctor, that Vicky had died. I still didn't know whether Sarah was dead or alive. I knew Trevor was alive. And it was not until about 9:30 that evening. It's a long story, Les. I could take up the whole thing telling you the story, but finally found out at 9:30 that night that it was two of them, and the bottom just totally dropped out of my world, if I'm totally honest, Les. But getting back to what you were saying about Trevor, I still don't know to this very day how he coped walking onto that pitch, or how it happened that Sarah and Vicky ended up side by side on the pitch, because they were both carried out of the Pen 3 by different people who didn't know that my girls were sisters, but they ended up lying side by side on the pitch just in front of the goal mouth. But how Trevor walked onto that pitch and found them lying there, and he tried to resuscitate Vicky and had to suck vomit out of her mouth, which, by the way, probably only I would know this, that for months and months and months, for the first year, he couldn't get rid of the taste of the vomit in his mouth. And the only thing that would take it away was Marks and Spencer's ginger beer. And we used to have bottles and bottles of it in the house. In the end, he had to see a psychiatrist because he thought he was going mad because of this taste in his mouth, the taste of the vomit that he'd sucked from Vicky's mouth. And I kept saying to him, it's perfectly normal, as the psychiatrist said to him, it's perfectly natural, it's a natural reaction. Anyhow, moving back to Trevor, how he didn't have a heart attack on that pitch that day, seeing them there. And then, how do you make a decision like that? I've got nothing, like you said, Les. My heart breaks for Trevor having to make that decision. I don't know how he, all I know is he did his very best, but he's still, and I bet if Trevor was here tonight, I bet you, Pat shouldn't be saying this, but I actually think that he would still feel slightly guilty that he hadn't been able to get both of them in that ambulance and that he had to leave Sarah. I don't know. I mean, if there's ever a decision you don't want to have to make, well, that's it, isn't it?
Yeah. As I say, it's one of the, I don't think anybody would ever, ever have to make a more difficult decision than that, because you've got two loved ones and you can either, go with one and stay with the other one, or stay with the other one and let the other one go. It's a decision, you know, that, you know, Trevor made, and I'll always admire him for doing what he did, because, as I said before, he couldn't win. So when you finally met up with Trevor again, and you had to go back to the gymnasium, did you have to look on the wall at photographs or something to see?
Yes, I did, because we as I say, we knew Vicky was dead because she was taken to the hospital and she died there. They'd tried for about 20 minutes to revive her. They, you know, she'd been given adrenaline injections, defibrillators, everything, and they couldn't save her. And I was told this when I was on my own. I still hadn't been reunited with Trevor then. When I got to the hospital, he'd asked them not to tell me, to wait till he was there. Anyway, they went ahead and told me. And Trevor had gone from the Northern General Hospital where Vicky died to the Hallamshire Hospital, where other victims had been taken, other people had been injured, were taken, and to see if that's where Sarah was, but she wasn't there. So the Northern General Hospital telephoned him and said, "We've got Jenny here, we've told her about Vicky. You know, you need to come back to the Northern General Hospital." So he came back, we were reunited, and then he asked me, had I seen Vicky? And I said, no. They told me I wasn't allowed to see her because she was the property of the coroner of South Yorkshire. She wasn't anything to do with me anymore, which I just think added to the trauma in a way, to be told that A, Vicky had died, and then to be told she was absolutely nothing to do with me anymore was just added to the trauma, to be quite honest with you, Les. So when Trevor arrived, he was upset that I hadn't been allowed to see her, so much so that the nurse called a police officer over to us, and he said, "Well, you can't see her anyway." And again, we were told that she was the property of the coroner of South Yorkshire. And in any case, they'd taken her back to the football ground. So they'd taken her out of the hospital in a hospital gown and everything, and taken her back to the hospital. Taken her back to the football ground, because the coroner had ordered that all the deceased had to be together back at a temporary mortuary, which, as you know, Les, was in the gymnasium at the football ground at Hillsborough. And so we had to go back then. And we didn't have a car. Our car was still in the car park. So the social worker drove us back to the football ground. And when we arrived, we were asked to look at all these Polaroid photographs on a big green baize board. And I identified Vicky, but I couldn't find Sarah. And in the midst of all this, I felt relief that Sarah wasn't on this board. And the police officer just said to me, "Look again, love." I said, "I can't see her." And they said, "Look again, love." And when I looked again, I saw her. It's making me feel quite emotional now, actually, because I didn't want to see her, because that meant it was both of them. And that, as I say, is when just everything became surreal, actually, Les. And then we were asked to identify, would we like to see them, which I'd been asking for since they told me Vicky had died. And they were brought to us in body bags on little low trolleys, and I got down on the floor between the two body bags, and they unzipped them, and I picked each of them up out of the body bags and hugged them. And the one thing I noticed was that Sarah was still warm. And I asked if they were sure that she was dead, because she felt really warm where Vicky didn't. And And that after that, we would that was a couple of minutes, and then we were taken behind a screen, sat at a table, and questioned, and had to make statements about our day. And as I said earlier, a lot of the questions, most of the, in fact, most of the questions were about alcohol. So we knew then that something, obviously, that something was being concocted about what had happened, because the whole basis was about alcohol, the questioning. And statements were taken, and we did have a lawyer present, which I guess we should have done, and not the right time really to make a statement when you'd just identified your daughters on a dirty gymnasium floor in body bags.
No, it isn't. And when you think about it, we're all of a certain age, Jenny, and we were all brought up by our parents that to say, if you're ever in trouble, go to a policeman. The police had, if you seen when I was a kid, if you seen a policeman walking down the road and he stopped you, you'd sort of stop and you'd say, yes, sir, no, sir. And you'd always thought that the police were really good. On that, from that day onwards, I totally lost trust in the police, for a number of reasons. What you went through, and when you think about it now, what you're telling us, they were starting to cover up, weren't they? Even when you hadn't, even sort of, identified, your daughters, they were concocting a series of events that they were hoping that people in emotional distress, as you were, would just say anything so they could say, well, that's what they said. So they were planting the seeds, weren't they? And then on the Wednesday after, I think it was, or the Thursday, that's when that rag run the headline, which is the narrative that is still believed today by thousands and thousands of people.
Like you, Les, I've been brought up. We lived next when I was a. I mean, I don't know if you've ever read my book, Les, but I lived next door to the. I was brought up in a small town called Yarm in North Yorkshire, and we had the village to, with a little police station with a sergeant and a couple of the ordinary police officers. And we lived next door to the police. So I was brought up that, and the police officers then where we lived in Yarm knew everybody by name. And if you're coming out of school and you were like running or everything, they'd say, now stop the running, and we would. There was somebody who you trusted, who you respected, and as you said, who you went to when you were in trouble. So and I brought Sarah and Vicky up same way. We'd never had any problems with the police at all. I don't think I'd even had a parking ticket then. And so the police weren't somebody, we respected the police as a family. And so that night I couldn't understand why we were being treated like criminals. It was sort of alien to me, to be quite honest with you, Les. So very similar to you in that respect, and it does make you look at the whole situation in a very different way, and policing, when they've concocted this cover up. And it was very obvious. I can remember when we got home that night, Trevor said, "We're going to be shafted," and I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, they're going to blame the fans for all these people dying." And I couldn't really take all that in. But as again, as you've said, when the Sun, that awful article in the Sun, but it wasn't just the Sun, Les. It
I
was
know.
their headline that I think upset everybody when they stated it was the truth. The other newspapers went down the same lines. However, they said it as supposition, not as actual fact as the sun did. Because I can remember one of the things Trevor did the next morning was get all the newspapers because he was convinced that there was a cover-up already, and this was a said on in the first couple of days. So yeah, it's one of those really, isn't it, Les? And then and you're it's like you're living on another planet that you can't believe that you lose your trust in everything, to be quite truthful with you. All the things that you think were stable things in your life have gone. And little did we know that it would take 26 years from that night to get the correct inquest verdict, 24 years for the Hillsborough Independent Panel to find out the truth about really of what had happened that day. I mean, that's a long time. It's, 24 years to get to that point, 26 years to get to the point of the correct inquest verdicts, 26 years for the people who died to have the correct inquest verdict of unlawful killing, which is legally gross negligence manslaughter to a criminal standard. And then 26 years for the Liverpool fans to be totally exonerated of any blame whatsoever. And by the way, without the Liverpool fans being exonerated of any blame whatsoever, that verdict of unlawful killing wouldn't have stood for me, to be quite truthful with you. The Liverpool fans, it had to be the two things. It had to be that the victims had to have the verdict of unlawful killing, and the Liverpool fans had to be totally exonerated of any blame for it to be the right verdict. And it was, thank goodness. But then it goes on to the criminal courts, and there was no accountability. Duckenfield never once had to go in the witness box in a criminal court and be cross-examined by the prosecution, not once. He chose to take the Fifth Amendment and not say anything. In fact, at the trial in at the trial up in Preston, he didn't even go in the dock. He sat with his lawyers playing on his computer all day. So I don't know whether you wanted me to speak about that side of it, Les, but it's
Any
all
tip?
part it's all part of the journey. And I feel in a way that I went down the rabbit hole with Alice in Wonderland, and I've been at the Mad Hatter's Tea Party. Every time I went to court, I got that feeling because three High Court judges quashed the first inquest verdicts of accidental death because they said it was the evidence wasn't true evidence. The evidence was flawed. And then we get into the criminal courts, and that was their only defense. So that flawed evidence was used in three trials to defend what had happened that day. The Liverpool fans being late, ticketless, drunk, more or less that they'd caused the deaths. And it was their misbehaviour that had caused it. And yet, three High Court judges in 2012 deemed that that was flawed evidence. Hence, the first inquest verdict was quashed. So why were they allowed to use that in the criminal courts? Why were you allowed to use, and that's the question I'll ask forever, and I've never had a proper answer for that. Why are you allowed in the criminal courts? And I think this is something that needs addressing. Why are you allowed to use flawed evidence in defense in a manslaughter trial? It's wrong.
It
It's
is. It
wrong. The criminal justice system have totally let everybody down on this. They've not only let down the people who died and their families, but they've let the supporters down as well. They've let all the Liverpool fans down. It's wrong. And I personally, going forward, if there was anything I'd like to see, is there to be more continuity between the courts, because the criminal justice system isn't geared, particularly the criminal courts, for historic cases like Hillsborough. We didn't get our case, our manslaughter case, to court until 30 years after the event. Therefore, you know, the defendants were all 30 years older. So they looked like old men standing there in the courts accused of these crimes, when they were young, fit men, middle-aged fit men at the time they committed these crimes. And I think a jury is quite influenced by that. And so to me, I personally think that they, for historic cases, there has to be something different. It has to be where, I don't think the criminal court is the place for it, not the criminal court as it stands. It needs to be in a court where all the evidence can be looked at, not what's decided by the defendants and the prosecution, which evidence can be looked at. All of the evidence has to be looked at, like it was in HIP. Otherwise, you're just not going to get the correct verdict. Sorry, I've got on a roll there with that. It's just how I think. If you're talking about wanting to improve things, for
Jenny,
that goes for all historic. I mean, you wouldn't like similar, quite similar to, you know, war crimes. How historic war crimes, they're not put into an ordinary criminal court in front of an ordinary jury usually. All of the evidence is looked at by a team of judges, and they get to see everything so that they can make a more correct decision, if you like. It's not conjured up, if you like. Having witnessed, I'm sorry, but having sat there for a whole year up in Preston, and again, I've not missed a day of any of the trials and the inquests and the court cases and things. And particularly in the criminal courts, it's almost decided before, well, we can say this, but we can't say that. You can say that because, I mean, how a jury, but yes, in the most recent case they can, but not in a case that's being listened to or heard 30 years later, 30 years after the event. As I say, in fact, a lot of the witnesses couldn't give evidence because they had either dementia or they died or they'd whatever. So it's not really the place to have witnesses, live witnesses coming either. It's got to be from all the documentation that's available, really. As I say, as they do in war crimes, and the age of the defendant shouldn't really matter, to be quite truthful. Hey ho, sorry, that's me on my. So I'll put the soapbox away now. I don't know what you think of any of that. What do you think about that?
Yeah,
I think I think you. That when you're at the independent panel, I think that's the only way to get a fair system.
Yeah, if you, that's right.
You will never get a fair system while you use the legal system, because it's skewed in the favour of the establishment. It always has.
Well,
and,
yeah.
In most cases, very rarely do you see, especially in football tragedies, it's always in the favour of the establishments. They're never going to turn on each other. I'm sorry about that, eh?
And the establishment put such a good case together as well, with Margaret Thatcher and Douglas Hurd at the time. For a start, I put a complaint in quite recently for this IOPC report that they've been taking 11 years so far to write. Well, it's supposed to be going to be published later this year. And I put a complaint in that I'd like it to be answered in there is why Duckenfield wasn't suspended on the day. You know, we'd already had several deaths, and I won't say exactly how many, but it was into the 80s, I think, and he was still there the next day in his uniform on the Leppings Lane terraces, full uniform, chatting away to Margaret Thatcher, who was the Prime Minister at the time, and Douglas Hurd, who was the Home Secretary. There's no way he should have been allowed to do that. You know, absolutely no way. And I want to know why Peter Wright, who was the Chief Constable at the time, didn't suspend him straight away, where there was any deaths whatsoever, even if it had been one, two, or, you know, a small number of deaths, but there's a huge number of deaths, and he wasn't suspended until he'd admitted at that point that he'd lied about the Liverpool fans breaking down those gates, Gate C, and of more or less charging in, and yet he wasn't suspended, and he'd admitted to his chief constable that he'd lied. So he perverted the course of justice within minutes of this happening. And it just beggars belief, really, what happened. But I mean, we couldn't, HIP couldn't find, the Hillsborough Independent Panel couldn't find any evidence for Margaret Thatcher's involvement. But there wouldn't be any, would there? You know, there's not going to be written evidence of what she concocted along with Douglas Hurd. And she had a thing about football fans anyway. She was at the time trying to get the bill through to have identification cards, if you remember.
Yeah.
Do you remember that? And so that plan didn't go ahead, did it? So I think if it had been left to just a few coppers fiddling the books, if you like, I don't think this would have lasted as long. It had to come from the top. It had to have government backing to last as long as it did, to be quite truthful with you.
Did you ever have the displeasure of meeting Thatcher?
Yes, I did meet Margaret Thatcher. Do you want me to tell you what she said to me? Because I'd like you to know, if you people there can tell me,
please,
if this makes any sense to you.
Please do.
It was, if you remember, there was the service within about 3 to 4 weeks of the disaster happening at the cathedral in Liverpool. And the Duke and Duchess of Kent came along, and Margaret Thatcher and Douglas Hurd, and all the so-called important people were there. And at the end of the service, four members of each family of the deceased were invited to go down into the crypt at the cathedral and have a cup of tea and meet all these so-called dignitaries. Well, Margaret Thatcher came over to me, and I know it had been announced that there was going to be a Taylor inquiry. Lord Peter Taylor was going to do an inquiry into the disaster. So I was quite pleased to meet Margaret Thatcher, because I thought, oh, you know, she'll be able to help me with this, you know. So I said to her, oh, Mrs. Thatcher, can you please make sure that the Taylor inquiry isn't a whitewash. Now, guess what her answer was? I don't think you'll be able, nobody on this in this world or any other world would be able to get. She leaned forward, and as you know, I'm quite vertically challenged. But she leaned forward, put a hand on my shoulder, and she said, my dear, she said, a mother's place is in the kitchen, filling the fridge with food for Christmas. Now, this was at the end of April. Now, tell me, can you make that? Now, I was there. The four people who were there representing Sarah and Vicky were, in this crypt part of it anyway, were myself, Trevor, Trevor's mum, and my brother. And friends now say to me, why, you know, what did you say to her? I said, nothing, because I said, I looked, we, the four of us just looked at each other and said, I thought, how do you make sense of that? But that was exactly, if you rang Trevor up now and said to him, what did Margaret Thatcher say to you in the cathedral? He'd tell you word for word what I just said. We've never been able to fathom. It was wrong at every level. It was telling a mother, telling me that my place is in the kitchen as a woman. Can you imagine all the women's rights people now?
Yeah.
The equality people. She was telling me my place is in the kitchen, filling the fridge with food. For Christmas, Christmas was months away. It was going to be our first Christmas without Sarah and Vicky, so it's going to be a nightmare anyway. So it was just wrong on every level that you want to have
the it out, right? The irony of that, Jenny, is that, you know, like, when she lost her son in the desert, you know, her attitude couldn't have been any more like for a mother than she would. She sent everybody out searching for him, you know?
Yeah.
You know, like, I wonder why a mother's place wasn't in the kitchen filling her own fridge at the same time instead of sending half the world out looking for him.
And where did Christmas come into it? You know, we're in April.
Unbelievable.
Unbelievable. Yeah, it's... and for a woman in her position, you know, Prime Minister of this country, I can't fathom it out. But it's exactly, and it's word for word, it's engraved on my brain.
Wow.
What she said that
Jenny, day. Jenny, I'm just backtracking a wee bit. I was going to speak before, but obviously it's a busy night. But I just remember, like Les said, we were all there. I was there with my new bride. I'd only been married a few months.
Wow.
And all I saw on that day was Axel Herrera was from Liverpool fans. That's all I saw. We came out of that ground and in a daze, and like Les said, there were no mobiles, there were queues for phones. The people of Sheffield were fantastic. They were calling us into the houses to use the phone. But we drove home in a daze. We managed to get in touch with our loved ones and said we were on our way. But we got up the next morning and we didn't know what to do with ourselves, and we had Radio Merseyside on, and they said the ground's open if you want to go and just, you know, just be there. And this lad come on, absolutely bereft he was. And he said, look, I was there when the policeman opened the gates. And up until that point, even hours later, it was, you know, the story that was being mooted was that it was forced down the gates. And I can't remember who was, I think it might have been Roger Phillips was hosting the programme on Merseyside. And he said, what did you say then? He said, I was next to the policeman who opened the gate. And at that moment, it was like, that was the moment, I think, that we all, it wasn't released, but it was up until that point, all the way through the night. And that next day, up until mid-afternoon, I think it might have been, was this story being touted by the media and everyone else that Liverpool fans had forced the gate. And it wasn't until that lad, he said, look, I stood next to the policeman and he asked me to move so he could open the gate.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, that's when we realised that all these lies that were being peddled were lies. And you know, I don't know. I just don't know what the feeling was. I wouldn't say relief, because I went to Anfield with my wife, as I say, and I met a couple of mates there, and we literally had to pull us off the turf because we were so upset. But, you know, to think that the authorities at that early stage were trying to put the blame on innocent people. And as I say, all I saw that day, me and my wife saw, was bravery by the Liverpool fans who were doing a lot more than the authorities were that day, to be honest.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. Without the Liverpool fans, we wouldn't have been looking at 97 deaths, we'd have been looking at hundreds, because the Liverpool fans saved many lives that day. I mean, they carried my daughter Sarah, whose birthday it is today, by the way, and they carried her on a stretcher. I've got all the photographs of that, you know, during our long journey. I know it's an overused word, journey, but it has been a long journey. And they actually came and gave evidence at the second inquest, because at the first inquest, none of the evidence after 3:15 could be heard. And of course, that prevented all the bravery by the Liverpool fans being heard, didn't it? Mm-hmm. Really convenient. It was just a very, very one-sided inquest. And actually, that's what was said to the jury, even at the first inquest, that Liverpool fans, the whole essence of the first inquest was that it was the Liverpool fans' fault. You know, and all this, as I say, this flawed evidence that it took until 2012 to have that verdict quashed, and to have to have, and then until 2016 to have the Liverpool fans exonerated, because that mud, and not, and even that doesn't stop that mud that was said in the Sun. That doesn't stop fans still shouting that to Liverpool fans at games. You know, this hate chanting at football matches. You know, that mud still sticks to this very day. Those lies that were told on the first day about the Liverpool fans still sticks. In fact, it was White's press agency who'd got their story from South Yorkshire Police who gave that narrative to all the newspapers. Hence, we got The Sun writing what they did, and all the other newspapers writing exactly the same thing. In fact, was it The Star wanted to say, I think their headline, and thank God that the their editor changed his minds about it. The headline was going to be Liverpool Scum.
Wow.
Referring to the fans. And apparently their editor decided not to go with that, where stupid Kelvin McKenzie, who was editor of The Sun at the time, he ran with the story exactly as he'd been told. But I'm not just saying this. This isn't supposition. This is the truth. Their story came from South Yorkshire Police. They gave that story on the Saturday night to White's press agency for the media to pick up on. That cover-up started that very afternoon.
Well, Paul Widdop.
If we hadn't have had HIP, yeah, the Hillsborough Independent Panel, that would have still been thought to be the truth publicly. That would have been the truth. I mean, that is so scary that it's unthinkable, isn't it? It's just unthinkable.
I think Paul Widdop, he actually was spoke on all the news programmes on the day after. And I remember his words to this day. He called Liverpool fans a tanked up mob. That's what he called us.
He did.
And I couldn't believe when the sort of charges got brought years later, the people who were facing criminal charges, that he didn't, because he was one of the ones who I thought would have been right up there for perpetrating the course of justice because of what he'd said on national television, calling us a tanked up mob. And to this day, I can still see his face, you know, saying it now. And like, it just disgusts me. It absolutely does. It changed me. And you think for like, you know, people like yourself who lost their daughters, and people lost, you know, 10-year-old sons, and fathers and sons died, and he's calling people tanked up mobs when he knew who was responsible. It was the police.
And they used the same, strange enough, because there'd been no consequences and no accountability for what happened that day. They used the same narrative in Paris at the European Cup final there. It was the same three things: ticketless, drugs, overcrowd, you know, too many fans turned up without the tickets and whatever. They used exactly the same narrative as South Yorkshire Police. That's why there has to be consequences for what, you know, for anybody who commits crimes, there has to be consequences. Otherwise, they just get this same old blueprint out and use the same thing over and over again. Thank God that Liverpool Football Club, with Billy Hogan, actually took them on.
Yeah,
he actually took on UEFA, and the Liverpool fans were exonerated more or less within months, wasn't it, or straight away? And you know, it didn't take 26 years as in the case of Hillsborough, thank goodness, because really the club put themselves forward, and as I say, Billy Hogan took them on, and Spirit of Shankly and the other supporters groups and things had somewhere to go with it. But did you have any of you there read Theresa May's book?
No.
Well, I don't know whether you knew, but when with the Hillsborough Independent panel, it was Gordon Brown and Lord Michael Wills who really worked hard at pushing that forward. And then, of course, we had a change of government. And Theresa May was the new Home Secretary with the Conservative government. And she's recently written her memoirs. And in the memoir, she speaks about Hillsborough. And one of the things that she says is that when she took over, she believed all the propaganda about Hillsborough and the Liverpool fans. And of course, Theresa May had the job of deciding whether to go forward with HIP. And apparently all of her ministers didn't, you know, were all advising her not to take it forward because it had happened on a Conservative government watch, and they didn't want it all dragged up again. And in the meantime, she arranged a meeting with the executive committee of the Hillsborough Family Support Group. And she says in a book that it was that meeting with the executive committee that convinced her to actually, no, she was going to go ahead with the Hillsborough Independent panel. And one of her ministers felt so strongly that she shouldn't be meeting us that on the day we were there, he hid in a cupboard so that he didn't have to meet us.
Wow.
Now, she actually, that is actually in her book on the chapter on Hillsborough, that her minister actually hid in a cupboard because he so didn't want to meet the families.
Yeah. I mean,
what does that tell you? This book was published, as I say, earlier this year. And I was astounded that she'd actually come forward and was so honest about that. But to be quite honest, I was one of the people on that executive committee, and she certainly was the best Home Secretary that we've ever had to deal with. And she made sure that we had a level playing of funding as well, because it was one of the things we asked for. Because one of the things that happens when you're up against the state, up against high, powerful people, you just don't have the funds to take them on a lot of the time. They have all these top lawyers that are paid for by the taxpayers of this country. In the first inquest, that 40 odd of the families clubbed together, and so that we could have the people who died represented at the inquest, and all we could afford was a junior barrister. We did speak to a QC, and he said, well, you can either have the Rolls Royce, which is me, and he said how much that was going to cost, and it was way above our funding. And he said, oh, you can have the clapped out Mini, which was his junior. That's how he referred to his junior, as the clapped out Mini. So we ended up with the clapped out Mini. But he was, to be quite truthful, he did quite a good job. He did the best job he could, because he was up against Sheffield Wednesday Football Club, Sheffield City Council, each individual police officer. They all had top lawyers, top QCs, all with their huge teams. And we had one junior barrister and one solicitor. That was our team representing the people who died. So considering what he was up against, he did a really good job. And he was paid by the families to represent the people who died. And he ended up having to represent everybody who'd ever worn a Liverpool shirt, including Heysel, because they threw Heysel at us and everything at that first inquest. It was just astounding. When I look at all the stages with the families, the fans, and the people of this city and everybody who supported us. We did so well. I know it took a long time, but we all stood together for a very long time. And in the end, we did get the right inquest verdict. We didn't get the accountability. I don't think we were ever meant to get the accountability. It was almost an impossible task. But we did get the correct inquest verdict. The Liverpool fans were exonerated. So we have to also look at the positive things that we did achieve by all standing together.
Yeah, they certainly took on the wrong city, didn't they, Tom? I know you.
Yes, in fact, I remember that, Les. When I, do you remember after the inquest, there was we were invited to St George's Hall the following day, and the families walked out, and I'll still never forget that day for as young as I live. When I walked out, there was this sea. Apparently, there was over 30,000 people there, wasn't there? All I could see was people right across to Lime Street Station, right away, right across. It was just astonishing. And the thing I'll always remember is this big banner, and that's exactly what it said. They picked on the wrong city. And I thought, yes, they did. And, I bet they were quite shocked at how long we stood there. And they kept knocking us down, and we kept coming back and knocking us down, and we came back again. And I don't think they ever envisaged that we'd still be there. And there's still stuff to be done 35 years later. There's still improvements to be made. We've got the Hillsborough Law coming along, which I think needs to be strengthened. I don't think a voluntary duty of candour will do much good, because if it's voluntary, they're not going to volunteer, are they? There has to be consequences if you lie, consequences if you pervert the course of justice, which is what they did with their non-duty of candour, if you like. And I'm astounded that there isn't already one in the police anyway. You know, of all the people who need to tell the truth, it's them. And but there you go. And also the public advocate. I'm a great believer that we do need a public advocate, which the government have now said we will have. But what they've not mentioned is that it has to be independent. We have to have an independent public advocate who's got some power and is truly independent of being influenced with the government, not the patsy that the government is suggesting. It's got to be somebody with power and somebody who is truly independent, so to make sure, you know, that we're going to get fair play here, because there's no fair play. There was never any fair play as it stood with the Hills after the Hillsborough disaster. So somebody who's on the victim's side, if you like, and make sure that they get a fair deal. That could go along with the Hillsborough Law, but as I say, the Hillsborough Law needs tightening up as well. So there are things. I'd just like to see the whole criminal court system change for things like this. I'm pleased you said what you said. Sorry, are you Thomas?
Thomas. Yeah.
I'm pleased you said what you said about it should be some kind of panel like the Hillsborough Independent Panel, where everything gets looked at. That is exactly my idea. And there should be judges looking at that and coming to a decision, because the criminal court's just not fit for purpose in these particular cases, historic cases.
They're not impartial, are they? You'll never get impartiality. You know, when I was listening to your story before, Jenny, about yours and Trevor's, I'd never told anybody this story, you know. Graham Hammond used to play football for my team. Yeah, Graham, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And he's my middle boy's, one of my middle boy's best friend. I go to the game with him all the time. And do you know, the Wednesday before the game, I went to, Phil was working in, the dad was working off Lark Lane in the post office. And I went in to see him to pick up a book. And I was saying at the time, you know, was Phil going to the game? He said, Phil, young Phil was going to the game. I said, how's he getting down? He said, he's going on a coach, you know. And then when I'd gone down, and then when we come back, I'd seen everything unfold at the ground. And when we come home, we were back in the house, and then we got a phone call about 10 o'clock to say that Philip was missing, you know, young Philip. And Phil and Hilda had gone down, you know, down where I'd made the way down. Yeah. Like, it was like for the whole of that, you know, for the next day. And I always say to Les, Graham, I love them to pieces, you know, I love Phil, I love Hilda. But I always think, you know, when you were saying about how you needed each other, and I think, you know, it must have been, you can't imagine what he must have gone through at that time. You know, it's heartbreaking that you were treated the way you were treated.
Yeah, on top of the loss. And what it has done as well over the years, because we had such a fight on our hands, it delays the grief taking its proper course. Mm. Because you're all together and the main purpose is about getting to the truth of how your loved ones died, not dealing with the loss of them, just getting to the truth of how they died. And that took 26 years of lies and corruption from high-powered people. And, you know, we've got to stop this culture of the people with power protecting themselves. And that's what it's about. They all get together and they protect themselves. You know, and people like the Hillsborough families and anybody else who finds themselves in this awful situation are left to face with the consequences of their actions, of the lies and the cover-ups and their failures. We have to deal with the consequences of their failures instead of being able to deal with the loss of our loved ones. We're having to deal with the consequences of the failures of how they died. And that can't go on. That something's got to change. And unless, I think the way to change it is to have consequences for their actions. They've got to be accountable for what they do, because until people are, this will just carry on. This will go on. I mean, we've got the Grenfell Tower. They've been put through the same stuff. We had the Windrush. We've got the blood, the contaminated blood people. You know, we've got all these, and they all came after us. The postmasters what they've been put through. And the point is that there's never any consequences for their wrongdoing. Never any, they don't ever have to account for their failures. And until they do, these things will continue. And I think that's really my focus now. Not that I think we should all be thinking like that. I think the taxpayers of this country should be thinking of that, because they're paying for their failures as well. They're paying for the failures of the people in power.
Yeah, Jenny, can I just take you back a little minute to I think what many people believe was the moment, sort of the tide turned a little bit to getting the independent panel and eventually the new inquest, was when Andy Burnham come to speak at the memorial service, and you know he stood up and all of a sudden somebody shouted justice, and then the whole cop give it to him. Now, can you just give us a little bit of background to that? Whose idea was it for him to come, or was it just something that was like said to the family support group, look, Andy Burnham's coming today, so you had no choice? Or was it somebody like your committee who decided that he was going to come and talk that day? Because over the years, Nobody from government, as I can remember, because I've been to them all, nobody from any government had ever been.
No, because they haven't, you're right, Les, because we decided that we weren't going to have politicians or, well, not to speak anyway, you know, we could, the local, like Steve Rotherham and people like that. He was the mayor of Liverpool, who was very, very supportive. You know, they were invited to come along as guests, but not to speak. Where Andy was the first politician to speak at a memorial service, because the memorial services were about the loss of the love of the people who died. They were about the loss, and not about the politicians, if you like. It didn't come to the committee. It didn't come to the families. That I was vice chair of the group. I didn't know Andy was going to speak. I think he came along to the service, and I think he asked if he could speak. He said, I'd like to speak. So it all happened on the day, Les, just before. It wasn't planned at all, ironically. That wasn't planned. He just came along to the service, and I think he asked Margaret and Trevor if he could speak, and he got up and spoke. And I actually think if it hadn't have been for that lone voice, I'd love to shake that person's hand, because it was that lone voice, because Andy was just really going down the lines of what all politicians go down the lines of, you know, supporting and what have you. But when that lone voice spoke up and shouted justice, and then the rest of the cop came in, and don't forget there was about 30,000 people there that day. The club was shocked at how many people had turned up. And like you said, they're always shouting, and you've got to do something, you've got to do something. And then he did take it back to Parliament, down to the House of Commons on Monday. If it hadn't have been for that lone voice, and then the cop joining in, I just think that would have been a political speech. But then the whole tone of it changed, didn't it? It was that lone voice that changed everything.
Yeah,
and then the cop all supporting this lone voice. And I do know somewhere, but I've just forgotten. I do have that person's name somewhere, because I think we all owe him a lot. And the cop that day, and the fact that it was the 20th anniversary, so there was a huge crowd there. And Andy wasn't going to get away with any political things at all, was he?
No.
He had no choice but to do something with it, I think.
Yeah, I think if I remember rightly, Trevor had to stand up and tell everybody to sort of calm down.
They were wonderful, the crowd that day. Absolutely. I would expect nothing less from the Liverpool fans, to be quite honest with you. But yeah, they were wonderful. So if Andy thought he was just going to get up and be very supportive and sympathetic and everything else, and then go away and that would be the end of it. No, he left that ground knowing in no uncertain terms that he had to do something about this. He had to speak to the powers that be down in the House of Commons.
Yeah, as I say, it was that to everybody was the point where the start point of the, you know, of us fans being, you know, exonerated from any blame, and then the second inquest coming of, you know, unlawful killing, you know, and then I always felt though, Jenny, as a pessimist really, because, you know, the way the establishment were, that no sooner had we knocked one wall down that the establishment were gathered together in a dark room somewhere, and they were starting to build another wall. Yeah. And as soon as we thought we were getting somewhere, that wall would suddenly appear and you'd have to start knocking it down again. It was like all the stuff they used to get on, you know, from social media where they say, right, the second inquest are coming, the trials are coming up. Please don't mention anything about Hillsborough, because, you know, it can break the trial, it can jeopardize justice, and also, and then you had the former chief constable of Liverpool, Bettison, bringing out a book.
Oh.
You know,
Oh.
it just defies belief.
We campaigned as a family group how the police commissioners in Liverpool allowed him to come here and be chief constable of this city. Absolutely outrageous. Outrageous. You know, and he was the one who allegedly was well, headed the team of the people amending the statements,
Yeah.
Liverpool supporters' statements. And you know, and then to come here and be, I mean, what a brass neck he must have. What a brass neck. And he brought his girlfriend.
Yeah, he was coming here to spy on us. That's what it was. If he was in the city, he could try and find out what was going on to feed back to the powers that be so that they could try and, start with any. Right, they're going to do this, so we'll have our defense ready, so to speak, or we'll have our statement ready. And that's what it was all about for me. And it was, it was so shocking for this city that he was able to allowed anywhere near any job, never mind the
Yeah,
head cop.
exactly. We went outside the demonstrated really outside the well, in fact, we were allowed inside as well. We had banners and all kinds of things, really protesting. It was when he was being interviewed for the job, and yet the police commissioners still appointed him. And I just think, wow, how dare! But to even come here when he'd been part of the cover up. I just, as I say, there are so many things. That's why I say I feel like I've gone down the rabbit hole and I'm with Alice in Wonderland at the Mad Hatter's Tea Party, because things like that, there's no rational thinking to it, is there?
No, there's not.
Really, there's no rationality to it at all. It's like, what are you doing? How can you offend the people of this city with this chief constable? But hey ho, it happened, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. And then obviously, from the Hillsborough support and the brilliant Phil Scraton, who I have to mention on this podcast, because he I look at Phil as a hero of mine. Because of
Really?
the work he'd done and
Oh, yeah.
to clear the fan's name right from the word go and the books, and he turned down honours from the establishment. I loved the man to bits. I had the pleasure of meeting him and getting my book signed by him a few years ago. What a man he is. And he was on once he was on the independent panel, I had confidence then that report was going to be thorough and it was going to be the truth.
Yeah.
Right, and then when that comes out, and then we then get the second inquest, and the second inquest lasted so long, and you said you went to every day. Jenny, I've got so much admiration for you, to actually sit through that every day. You know what I mean? You must
2
have the,
years it was, Les. 2 years.
as I
Yeah.
say,
Yeah.
I just don't know how you did it, and you're sitting there and. And the day's going to come where you're going to hear about your two daughters, and then you're going to have to go through all the emotion again and again and again and bring back everything and hearing about actually what happened to them. Could they have been saved? If they'd have had more ambulances to come in, if they'd have had more equipment there, would they have been okay? Were they alive after 3:15? All sorts of things like that. You were finding out, and it's like it's happening all over again in many ways, isn't
Yeah,
it?
exactly. It is, Les. It wasn't an easy 2 years. In fact, I think I found that 2 years there really difficult. It was a difficult 2 years, and I can remember the day that of the verdicts. Actually, I'm sure you can. Did you? Because.
I remember I was in work and I knew they were due out at the, I can't remember what time it was now, but they said
At
they
the
were going to be
morning,
released. And I remember going out the office and just going on my phone and waiting. And I just remember just breaking down and crying when he heard, you know, all the, it was like 15-0, I think. And, you know, if the fans were exonerated and it was unlawful killing. And then, obviously, then, you know, I went to St. George's Hall and was outside St. George's Hall on the night where you were fought. And, like, it's one of them feelings for me where it was like a weight had been lifted off my shoulders, because all of a sudden, you know, we all have a degree of survivor's guilt. And, you know, you're now told you're not to blame, but you still feel as though, as I said to you at the start of this podcast, you know, we all got up on that day to go to a football match to support our team. And fate decreed that so many would not come back. And the reason I feel I've always felt guilty for 35 years and will always do so. And I mentioned this when I was on the podcast last year with Charlotte, was that because I had cop season tickets, I had tickets for the Leppins Lane. So that's what we were allocated on the cop. But I sold lottery tickets then for the Development Association. So the year before, for the semi-final when we were at Hillsborough, I went into Kenny Addison and asked him, did he have any stand tickets? And he sort of swapped my ground tickets for stand tickets in 88. So we got ground tickets for 89. And it was with me, I had my girlfriend with me this year. And all the lads have been telling us who'd gone into the Leppins Lane the year before, how horrendous it was. So I didn't want to go onto the ground again, especially because I had her with me. So I went into the Development Association again, and it was the Thursday, and I went in and asked Kenny Addison, did they have any stand tickets? And he said, sorry, Les, I haven't. And he said, everybody must be under the same thinking this year, because it was so bad in Leppins Lane the year before that they didn't want to go in there again. So only because my girlfriend was with me, and she said to me, I'm sure the players are leaving for Hillsborough. Now can we go round to the car park and watch them get on the coach? And we were stood in the car park just by the coach, and I noticed there was people going into the ticket office and coming out with tickets. So I said to her, just wait there a minute. I'm going to go in and see if they've got any stand tickets left. And I could pick the fella in the tickets office now. If I was had to do an identity, I could still see his face now. And I went in, and he was stood there, and I said to him, have you got any stand tickets left for Saturday? And he said, yeah. I said, would you swap them for ground tickets? And he said to me, you'll have to pay the difference, you know. And I said, I know that. So he said, how many do you want? I said, six together if you can. So he said, have you got the ground tickets on you? So I said, yeah, got them up my wallet, handed them over, and he gave me six stand tickets, and I paid the difference. And to this day, it lurked me forever that I don't know if anybody got them six tickets, and if they did, were they injured? Were they killed? And that sort of lives with you forever.
Yeah.
Because you just don't know. You know what I mean? If you've inadvertently just played an innocent part, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it does, and to get exonerated, you know, and saying the fans weren't to blame was such a weight lifting off your shoulder. And then he actually thought then, Duckenfield's going to get his comeuppance. He's going to get his comeuppance. He's going to be found guilty, especially then at the inquest when he finally admitted what he'd done. You know what I mean? I thought, well, he's admitted it now. When they go to court, he's got to be found guilty. And then the judge sort of abandons the trial. And would you believe that was on my birthday when that news come through? So that was one of the worst birthdays I'd ever had.
That was the judge who abandoned the trial. Wasn't the Duckenfield trial? It was the cover-up trial.
Right.
He said there was no case to answer the Duckenfield one. The first jury found him. It was a hung jury, so there had to be a retrial. And the retrial jury found him not guilty. But I'll tell you, the way that the judge sort of led the jury to that decision. Again, it's a farce. I was down that rabbit hole again. And the evidence that they didn't get to hear. So again, we're back to my point earlier, which I won't repeat because I'll get on another roll, Les, and I don't want to. But you know, that guilt that you carry must be awful. That must be absolutely awful. And I'm so pleased that being exonerated helped with that and gave you some peace at last.
Yeah, as I say, I didn't understand why I was feeling like I was feeling. And it was only many years later, would you believe, at the time where I sometimes used to do bits on LFC TV, that I was sat at home and I was watching a documentary that they'd produced. And it was somebody on that documentary, it was Andy Knott, who sells one of the fanzines outside Anfield, who actually said something on the documentary, and it resonated with me. And then I realised that what I was feeling was survivor's guilt because of what had happened over the tickets. And the fact was that I was in the stand above Gallopin's Lane, and I was trying to go down the front to help, but there's too many people there. So then I go back to my seat, and you're just watching, and you just feel so helpless that you can't do anything for anybody. And to this day, and I think Tommy and Peter probably say the same about this, to this day, I can recount my movement on that day from the time I got up on that morning to the time we got to the ground. Now, bear in mind, I'll tell you something else. We were the first ones in the stand because we got there. We went with the supporters club in Lower Breck Road. We got there, we parked up. And we said, oh, we'll just go in. We'll have a game of cards in the ground. So we got in. We stood outside. The gates had only just opened and we got in. And we were there the year before. And as you know, when you go into Hillsborough, you go through and the first thing you see is that tunnel. So and we were in there and we were thinking, we've got stand tickets. Where do we go? And there's a stairwell and it's off to the right. And we have to ask a steward, where do we go with these tickets? He said up there. So we were the first in the ground. And I can remember getting back to Liverpool. And I can remember getting back in my car. And I can remember Terry Lanane being on Radio Merseyside, giving people that certain coaches were now coming back. And there's more coaches to come back. And trains are coming back and things like that. And I can remember going to bed and listening to them phoning on Radio City with Clive Tilsley. I can remember getting up the next day, dropping my dad off at my uncle's and then just sort of, what can I do? As Tom said, you know, you're in the days, what can I do? And I went up to Anfield and was just stood outside Anfield. And I must have been outside Anfield about 9:30 in the morning, just because I didn't know what to do with myself. And then they opened, I was there when the gates opened and you could go in, and I just went and got on the cops where they used to stand and just stood, sat in front of the barrier and just started crying. And I just couldn't stop crying. And I must have stayed there for about an hour, and there's people coming up, total strangers coming up and just hugging you and putting their arms around you and saying, you know, oh, you know, don't worry about it, son, you know what I mean? It's not your fault, you know what I mean? And you just couldn't contemplate what had happened, really. You'd gone to watch a football match, and you'd seen what you'd seen, and you think to yourself, wow, what, you know, the police are supposed to be there to protect us, and they did nothing. All they did was line across the centre of the field, and you're having fans who were sort of making stretches out of the advertising boards. And the other thing they'll never forget is seeing a copper, when he was stood there with his stick walking along the front of the Leppins Lane end, and somebody's trying to climb out and he pushes him back in.
Yeah.
And it's just like, you know, just images like that sort of, you know, fill you with horrible, horrible, horrible feelings inside. And as I said at the start, Jen, I just don't know how you would cope and how you coped afterwards, because I couldn't imagine going to a match with Jamie or with Tom or with Pete, and then, you know, only me being the only one who come back, or one of them not being in the car when we come back because of something like you went through, and you had to travel from Sheffield to Middlesex, you know, with two empty seats in the back of your world, you know? And here we are now, 35 years later, and you have to go to if you ever go to Anfield to certain football matches and certain teams come to Anfield, and you're hearing the slurs on Hillsborough and stuff like that, and you think, how can people be so silly to do that? There's one thing about not wanting the team to win, or disliking the team, or disliking a group of supporters, but I wouldn't want to see any supporter of any football team or any families go through what you've been through and what the survivors have been through over the past 35 years, because it's cruelty. It's actually cruelty, and it's torture. And the establishment, they're just scum as far as I'm concerned. There's nothing else. And that includes the likes of Tony Blair and Jack Straw, by the way, who, when Labour got in, I actually thought, you know, right, we've got rid of the Tories now. The Labour's in power. And they did absolutely zilch. I wrote to Jack Straub and got a reply off him, which basically just said the usual claptrap. And like, you just thought, you know, is this what the Labour Party was back then? So you know, Jenny...
And you're right, Les. Labour did nothing for us for the 15 years that we're in. They gave us the scrutiny, the Stuart Smith scrutiny. And basically, Stuart Smith got to see the same documentation that 14 years later HIP came up with. And yet, Stuart Smith turned around and said, no, there was nothing untoward, nothing to answer. And after we'd had HIP, which was 14 years later, Margaret Aspinall and I, who was then chair of our group, and I was the vice chair, we were asked by Granada Television, would we do an interview with Jack Straw? He'd come up to Manchester for the Labour Party conference. And it just happened to be a few weeks after HIP had reported, you know, their findings. And we're in this hotel room in Manchester with Jack Straw. We were all mic'd up. The camera was there, and it was quite a small room we were in. And we're sitting around this little round table. And during the conversation, it became quite, you know, it became positive. It became apparent that Stuart Smith had got to, had actually seen all the stuff that HIP had seen and come up with the conclusions that he did. So I said to Jack Straw, are you telling me, Mr. Straw, that Stuart Smith saw all the same documentation that HIP have just seen and come to the conclusions that he did, that there was a say nothing untoward? And Jack Straw shuffled about a bit, and then he looked at me and he said, yes. I said, so that means that I had another 14 years of suffering and fighting to get the truth because of Stuart Smith's, you know, findings. And Margaret Aspinall spoke up and said, do you think you picked the wrong judge, Mr. Straw? And he paused, and then he said, yes. So, you know, as if, like you said, it's just Mad Hatter's Tea Party time again. And as I say, something definitely has to change. Perhaps Ian can help us with that. He's the politician here who deals with all these people down in the House of Commons. And hopefully now Ian's on the case.
Yeah,
we'll go forward in these changes that are so obviously necessary to everybody else, and not always apparent to those with the power. What do you think, Ian? Is it going to change? Are things going to change?
Well, it's in the manifesto, isn't it? So we've got to commitment that it's going to be implemented in the manifesto of Hillsborough. We've got the Real Two Legacy Project, haven't we, which we've been part of, which is the education elements. And for me, they're the two great legacies now, what we can give the families and the survivors, which is the education and the rewiring of the justice system to a Hillsborough Law. I think that's where we are, and I think that's hopefully what we're going to achieve over the next year or so.
What I personally think about the Hillsborough Law is that it needs tightening up. It needs to have consequences. It, you know, if they don't adhere to it, there has to be consequences. Otherwise, it'll be just...
That's
absolutely... Yeah, it isn't going to work. So I'm hoping that Ian's going to... When Keir's elected, because we did work with Keir Starmer as well. He was a DPP who was very helpful, actually, Keir Starmer. I did have time for Keir Starmer. He did help along with the, you know, he suggested a way of doing the second inquest. So I'm hoping that Ian will suggest to Keir, well, if you are going to implement the Hillsborough Law, it needs tightening up, and especially in the duty of candor, but there you are. And yes, Ian's mentioned the Real Truth Project, and I'm very honoured to have been invited by Ian to come to some of the presentations at Anfield. The LFC Foundation are doing a really, really good job on that. And the two that I've been to at LFC, the children have been amazing, absolutely amazing. The way they're engaging and really taking on board. And the way that the LFC Foundation have put the presentation together, it's just brilliant, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's fantastic, and I'm really proud and honoured actually, yeah, to be part of that, to be a small part of that, and yeah, and I'll help out with that as in any way that I'm invited to do. So yeah. Thanks, Ian. It's a really really good thing. Yeah.
That's a well deserved honour, that, Jenny. I think you've been a tower of strength to a lot of people over the last 35 years, and you know, as I've said to you many times on this podcast, and you know, I've spoke to you on many occasions before, I've got great admiration for you. You're an icon, you know, in this
steady
city.
Steady on,
Beth. Well, you are. What you've gone through, you're an inspiration. You're an inspiration. Because
listen, Ian's going to have to widen this door to get me out of this, if you carry on, out of this office.
I mean, I'm just, as I say, I'm just telling the truth, because that's what you are. You know, you've stood up, you've fought against the establishment, you've fought for the good name of the fans, the survivors, you know, and at the end of the day, on the 15th of April 1989, your world was crushed. And as you said, you have to start the podcast. You went as a family of four, and you come back, and that family of four was just broken, and it was never, it could never be repaired. But then even you and Trevor suffered the consequences. You went your own separate ways, but you kept friends, and you kept, you know, you're part of the same family support group, and you kept fighting for justice. We didn't get accountability, but we got justice. And just to finish the podcast, I'd like to thank you for coming on, you know, and telling your story. I'd like to thank Ian for chipping in at the end, Ian Byrne MP, and also thank Tom and Pete, as always, for joining us on the podcast. And as you always end the podcast by saying, don't buy the sun, justice for the 97, and you'll never walk alone. This has been an emotional podcast. Thanks again to Jenny. Appreciate it. See you all soon.
Thank you, Les. Thank you very much.